This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also download off our website over at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about the civil rights movement in the North. And with me to talk about this is Patrick Jones, the author of a fascinating new history entitled The Selma of the North, Civil Rights Insurgency in Milwaukee. Patrick Jones teaches at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks for having me, Matt. It's great to be here.
Tell me a little bit about yourself. Did you always want to be a historian? What took you that route?
Well, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. I was born in Baltimore and kind of saw the good and the bad of urban inequality there. And I was, from a young age, politically active and conscious and just trying to make sense of the world that we were living in.
Did that come from your family?
It did. My parents were a big D Democrats. My dad's a child of the Depression. They both grew up poor and kind of made it to the middle class. And so kind of FDR-type Democrats. I'm more the community activist, progressive lefty in the family. But definitely they're liberal Catholics, and you know, their political values are rooted in their faith. And then again, just growing up in a place like Cleveland, having kind of basic core, what I would call progressive or ideals, and then just encountering all these inequalities and trying to make sense of them in a place like Cleveland. And then I had some great teachers along the way that allowed me to explore these issues. And I thought about all kinds of things, law, politics. The thing I liked about history, well, teaching for me was transformative. So I saw the political potential in being a teacher and turning people on to new ways of thinking about their world, new ideas, and that possibility. But history appealed to me because it encapsulated everything. It's really interdisciplinary, and I could ask the kinds of questions I wanted to when I was in political science, and I asked political economy questions. Political scientists had a tendency to say, "Oh, that we don't deal with the economic stuff. You know, that's an economist. You go over and ask the economist," and he says, "Well, we're scientists. We don't deal with the political stuff." So it seemed to me when I was coming of age that the important questions kind of fell through the cracks, and at least in a scholarly academic way, history allowed me to fudge those disciplinary boundaries a bit and ask questions that brought together social and cultural as well as political and economic things.
And teaching, you say you enjoy teaching and the transformative power it has when you can tell students or show students a different way of thinking. What is your take on this current crop of students the last couple of years as far as their political sensibilities?
Well, I mean, it's been an interesting experience. I got my PhD here in Madison. I taught at Allegheny College in western Pennsylvania, which is in the poorest county in Pennsylvania. It was Tool and Die City, USA, but most of that's gone today, shipped overseas. And so there's a real reactionary, there was, I suspect there still is, a reactionary impulse there among particularly young men who their dads and grandparents used to work in these mills, have good jobs, unions were there and strong. And now all that's gone. Rates of domestic violence and things were significantly higher than the state. That was an interesting experience. Students there, while it was a small liberal arts college, they prided themselves on having a disproportionate number of students who were the first in their families to go to college. So something like 75-80% of the people were there on scholarship or aid or something. So for a liberal arts college, it had a little bit, in terms of class, mix of students. Now, I'm in Nebraska now, said to be red state America, and just in the 5 years, I just ended my fifth year there, and I've seen just in that time period a shift in students and just the culture in general there. It's a lot of evangelicals, a lot of kind of conservative, small town folks, but particularly among young people, something's changed. Many of my students who are fundamentalists or evangelicals supported Obama in the last election. There seems to be I would call it their palette of issues seems to have expanded. And even on some of the hot button cultural issues of the right, they're not as strident. So they may, some of them still adhere to kind of love the sinner, hate the sin when it comes to GLBTQ issues, for instance. But it doesn't seem to be a priority issue. And many of those students are into the environment. They're concerned about poverty and things. They dress in a kind of hip styling, too. So there seems to be something changing there. And I'm at a kind of ground zero at a more conservative place in the country. So something, I think, is changing. And I think within that religious right, there definitely seems to me, just anecdotally, to be a generational shift that's happening. Now, we'll see in our state. I live in Omaha but teach in Lincoln. For the first time ever, we're one of two states that splits their electoral votes, and the first time ever that happened in this last election, and the congressional district that encompasses Omaha went for Obama. That's a huge achievement and attributable to all the people that organized on that campaign. Yesterday, there was just an election, elected a Democratic mayor, another Democratic mayor to replace the outgoing guy, and that was a very contested race. But again, something's happening, and younger people are really the engine of that, I think, in Nebraska in general, in both Omaha and Lincoln, the two biggest cities mm-hmm. where two-thirds of the population of the state lives. So in that regard, it's been hopeful, I think, and a great learning for me as well.
Yeah, that's encouraging. You know, I got a sense of that when I was in Iowa, the day of the Iowa caucuses, just seeing the energy from young people who hadn't been involved in the process before, and they were taking great interest and showing a lot of enthusiasm. That's what helped broaden.
Well, with the recent, speaking of Iowa, Iowa is great to have as a next-door neighbor because they're really a step or two ahead of Nebraska in terms of kind of liberal progressive politics. And so with the recent gay marriage decision there, that's not only impacted Iowa, that's created a whole cascade of action in our own state, from discussion to things in the paper to people organizing to support what's happening in Iowa or reacting against it. But all that, I think, is creative energy and good positive development. And it goes against the type that these are things that happen in the Madisons or in the Californias or the Massachusetts, but not in the heartland of Nebraska or Iowa. So I think that's a really important development, not only for that issue specifically, but this general change or the possibility of change in tenor in our politics and some direction.
There's something going on there, that's for sure.
Right.
Tell me about this book, why you decided to focus on the Northern Civil Rights Movement.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. And in terms of race and inequality, it's a city that has the best. It's the first major American city to elect a black mayor in 1967. Langston Hughes publishes his first poetry there as a high school student. It's got a very long, old, and rich African-American community. At the same time, like Detroit or Chicago or Milwaukee, it ranks at the bottom in terms of urban inequality and the nexus of race and poverty and all these indicators. Growing up, I became very interested in urban inequality and race and poverty stuff. My dad worked for Blue Cross, and in the 70s, he was vice president of human resources, and he was transferred from Baltimore to Cleveland to essentially integrate women and people of color into the workforce there. So I had kind of a family culture that was interested in their big D Democrats, FDR-type Democrats, my parents. And so liberal issues and ideas were kind of a part of our family culture. As I became a grad student, what I realized was that the way we think about the civil rights movement, one, we think about the Southern movement in some distorted ways, but two, there really was not much of anything written on the Northern movement. And I knew there was struggle for racial justice in the urban North. When people did write about it, they wrote about kind of urban rebellions, race riots, things like that. It was a negative story oftentimes. So the Northern story entered the national narrative of the civil rights movement as a kind of straw man to say this is where the movement went wrong and declined. And it's kind of a tragic declensionist story. And I knew there was more stuff going on there. And I knew that the North needed to be taken on its own terms, in its own context. And I had a sense that race relations developed out of the unique circumstances of the urban North, but that were importantly different than the South. For instance, the urban industrial economy, the presence of strong labor unions, the presence of white ethnic working class communities, the importance of physical space to social relations and race relations there, the fact that African Americans, while faced with all kinds of inequality, had the right to vote. And so, though segregated, that vote increasingly mattered.
You also, Patrick Jones, talked about the role of the Catholic Church.
Right, and the presence of the Catholic Church, a dominant institution in a place like Milwaukee. You know, 40 to 50% of the population is Catholic. And because of the nature of the church, its hierarchical emphasis and an emphasis on obedience to authority, it really is a determinative institution for particularly those old type of Catholics, the traditional or more orthodox type of Catholics. And as a result, it's the institution that orders the way that many, particularly white ethnic urbanites in the Midwest and in the Northeast, understand their world, interpret their world, act on their world. For many of those Catholics, they don't turn to a politician to solve their problems. They turn to their local priest. My mom is one of these folks growing up in Baltimore. And if you ask her what neighborhood she grew up in Baltimore, she won't tell you the neighborhood. She'll tell you the parish.
And so it is in Chicago, too.
You know, so really important. And I think an important part of the book is kind of uncovering that history. And the church is in a bind. Church hierarchy is in a bind. On the one hand, it's got a growing but small number of priests and nuns and lay people who are interested in social justice issues, the civil rights movement, anti-war issues, and other progressive issues that are emerging in the post-war period. But on the other hand, their bills are paid by white working class Catholics who are overwhelmingly opposed to many of these movements and these changes. And so the church hierarchy is in an interesting position of trying to finagle that tension and allowing those priests and nuns to act out of conscience, but also not alienating its core constituency.
Well, in Milwaukee, it came to a head with a very interesting local priest, Father Grappi. Can you tell his story briefly?
Sure. Well, Father James Grappi is a fascinating and really important character. He ultimately becomes an important national figure in the civil rights movement and then the anti-war movement as well, the 60s writ broadly, the movement with a big T and a big M. He grew up on the white working class south side of Milwaukee. He's Italian, and he lived in a primarily Irish area, so he often would tell the story of not being able to go to the local Catholic church as a kid because he was Italian, and they would have to import an Italian priest, and they held mass in the back of a shoe store in his neighborhood. So he would say that, you know, he understood what it meant to be kind of ostracized and alienated a bit, but he would be quick to say, even so, that's nothing compared to what African Americans experience. But as he grew and decided to join the priesthood, he worked in the summertime with some Capuchin friars in the north side of Milwaukee, the segregated African-American side of town. They had a day camp. The Capuchins had been there for a long time, working in the community, knew the community and the racial dynamics and the changing demographics of that community pretty clearly. There was a priest by the name of Father Matthew Gottschalk that took Father Grappi and others under his wing, got them involved with a summer camp that they did there with young kids, mostly black kids, poor kids in the city. And that began a process of awakening. For Grappi, it was a spiritual awakening. He found in the struggles of African Americans and urban inequality the resonance of God and Christianity. And that set him on a journey. And so he gets more and more, more and more deeply involved with race. Father Matthew also takes Grappi and a couple of other younger priests at the time on a couple of trips south where they engage the Southern movement. They also engage Catholic churches in the South who are also taking it on the chin. The South is not a hospitable region to the Catholic Church. Some of those priests are involved with issues of race. And so they see both what's happening to the Catholic Church as well as race relations up close. And then what really breaks through to him significantly and transforms him in terms of being an activist and a civil rights leader is heeding Martin Luther King's call to go to Selma in 1965. It's something Grappi had wanted to do, as he would say later, sit in ecumenical prayer with religious people of all denominations in the context of the movement. He learns from Dr. King and SNCC activists about confrontational nonviolent direct action. He will come and apply that in Milwaukee, most famously during the open housing campaign of 67 and 68, which is essentially modeled on Selma. They'll put out a similar ecumenical call after being beaten on the south side of the 16th Street Viaduct. Hundreds of people will come from across the country to support that campaign. So he learns important lessons about organizing about activism, about confrontational, nonviolent, direct action. So he comes back, and at that time, in 1965, education is the main issue in Milwaukee. And he's been involved, but he becomes the vice chair of music, the Milwaukee United School Integration Committee, head by Lloyd Barbie and others. They had engaged in a series of boycotts, school boycotts, and they have started to block buses through human chains that
now
are
he
taking
must have
kids.
Been, I'm sorry to interrupt. He must have been reviled by the racist white community in Milwaukee.
Well, he's fascinating because, you know, Vatican II is happening, and he becomes the lightning rod for local Catholics. And so those who are in tune with the reform impulse in the Catholic Church and Vatican II see in him the promise of this new church that's less hierarchical, more oriented towards the world that we live in, not detached from it as the Catholic Church had usually been, more concerned with social justice and speaking to the inequalities of the world. And it's important to keep in mind that the Catholic Church, in terms of its social teaching, has a pretty righteous background that goes to the 19th century of supporting worker rights and things. And then that's balanced on the other side by fairly restrictive policies around the body, sexuality and things like that, traditional morals and things. So it's tapping into that more progressive tradition of Catholic social teaching. But so for some, Grappi became the embodiment of this reform, this possibility. But then for others, he becomes the embodiment of everything that appears to be attacking their, quote, way of life. So for white Catholics in Milwaukee, Grappi, particularly working class Catholics on the South Side, you know, he's from that community. And now he's living, by the time he's a priest, in North Omaha or North Milwaukee in the black community. And so he seems to be a race traitor. And then on religious theological issues, he seems to be a religious traitor. And again, you know, for white ethnic working class, you turn to your priest. And now here's a priest leaving the community, working with African Americans, and advocating many of the issues that white ethnic working class folks perceive to be threatening to their property values, their schools, their young daughters, all these things that are weighing in on them. Unfortunately, you know, that's misdirection. They are also victimized by many of the demographic and economic changes that are sweeping urban America, what we'd now call the beginnings of deindustrialization and globalization. But instead of turning their eyes to those issues, it's easier to see African Americans as a scapegoat.
I'm speaking with Patrick Jones. He's the author of The Selma of the North, Civil Rights Insurgency in Milwaukee. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Well, how ugly did it get?
Well, that's one of the amazing things about the story in Milwaukee, and that always raises eyebrows across the country when I talk about it. During the height of the open housing campaign, activists marched from the north side to the south side. Milwaukee is divided naturally by River Valley, and it was referred to as the city's Mason-Dixon line, physically distinguishing the largely segregated poor north side, African-American side of town, and the white working class south side. And after the civil disturbance in the summer of 1967 in Milwaukee, Father Grappi and the Youth Council and Commandos, who he was working with there, decided they had already been working on open housing, but they decided to press the issue.
And
in
these
the wake
commandos
of
aren't really carrying guns.
No, they actually, they're the Youth Council, it's the NAACP Youth Council. They had faced so much virulent racism from whites in Milwaukee on other protests, and then they weren't getting protection oftentimes from the police, who themselves tended to be white working class folks who often brought to the job discriminatory ways of, and stereotype ways of thinking about African Americans. They often beat up civil rights activists, arrested them for the most minor infraction. They had a tactical squad. The old Red Squad was readapted to go after the civil rights movement. Many stories I was told by a Youth Council and Commandos of being arrested for a petty offense, taken into the freight elevator of the Milwaukee Police Department. That elevator would stop in between floors. They would rough you up, beat you up, and then let you go there. There's also a long history, and as is the case in almost every American city, of strong police community tensions between the police and African-American communities. As we get away from the 60s and that will all just be exacerbated as we cut social welfare and things. But that's a long, long history there. But the commandos are formed as a self-defense group by the Youth Council and Father Grappi to organize young African-American men in the inner city to give them an outlet for their frustration and anger, to direct it in a constructive way into social justice activism. But some of these guys were in gangs. Some of them were in a weight club. Some of them were connected to some of the young women who were in the Youth Council, their cousin or sister. But their role was to protect marchers. They practiced what they called not violence, not nonviolence, and not armed self-defense like the Panthers. So they dressed in kind of Black Power garb. They used Black Power slogans. But they didn't carry weapons. They would march along the outside of demonstrators, and when white onlookers or the police would attack, they would fight back, and they did so often. So it's armed self-defense, but not with guns, but with their actual arms. And in that regard, Milwaukee complicates the way we think about nonviolence and armed self-defense and violence in the movement, and that there's a much broader spectrum of tactics and strategies that people employed in these movements. And so they're kind of in the middle. Again, it's not Kingian nonviolence exactly. It's not Panther armed self-defense. Mm-hmm. But when they march across to the South Side, the first few nights in particular, I mean, upwards of 10 to 13,000 angry white people come out. They're holding white power signs. They burn Grappi in effigy. They throw rocks and bricks, human feces, urine, firecrackers at marchers. They break through police lines. They beat them mercilessly, attack them many different times. It happens on the south side of the 16th Street Viaduct. The images are very reminiscent of the Selma campaign, voting rights campaign in 1965. That draws comparisons to Selma and earns Milwaukee the nickname among some of the Selma of the North, which is the title of my book. Dramatic images, and then which attract people from all over the country to come. So the level of massive white resistance in Milwaukee, like King saw in 1966 in Chicago, is on par with or exceeds the stories that we tell in the Southern narrative of Selma or Birmingham or Montgomery. And the level of hatred and violence against these nonviolent protesters is staggering and really mind-numbing, which then raises the question that many people ask, why don't we know this story? Why doesn't anybody tell this story then, these Northern movement
stories? Well, what's the answer to that?
Well, I think there's two pieces to that. One is that we tell the Southern story in a kind of distorted way. We tell it in a way that's a redemptive story of democracy. So, well, it might have taken a while, we say, but finally, us as Americans, we acknowledge this inequality of overt segregation and the lack of voting rights in the South primarily, and we overcame it. And so everybody now, from the present looking back, this is really about the present, not about the actual past here in the history. But so we tell that in that distorted way, and it allows Americans to feel like, well, we overcame that. We did it. That, you know, and American democracy was redeemed. Embedded in that, too, is that we're done with race, essentially. We're post-racial. Now, that's a distortion of that story. But the Northern movement story, the story I'm telling in the book, in this book, The Selma of the North, is a story about police-community relations. It's a story about urban poverty. It's about jobs. It's about housing inequality. It's about failed public schools. These are all issues that are unresolved today and that we still are dealing with. So part of my argument is that we don't tell these stories in part. We've lost a story that was national news at the time in 67, 68, the open housing campaign in Milwaukee. We've lost it in our historical memory, I think, in part because to confront these kinds of stories like Milwaukee, and there are these stories in every major urban center in the North and Midwest and West, is to then force in the present moment a confrontation with the unresolved issues of race and class and urban inequality today.
So we don't want to hear the story because it doesn't have that redemptive conclusion that is attached to the Southern story.
Exactly. I mean, my advisor is a great civil rights historian named Tim Tyson. He knows well the brutality and tragic narrative of race, particularly in the South. And when I was writing, this was my dissertation at first before it became a book. And, you know, when he finished my dissertation, he read it, he closed it, he gave it to me, and he looked at me with kind of tears in his eyes. And he said, man, I mean, this is just depressing. It's a bummer of a story in a way. And what he meant is that, you know, Milwaukee today remains one, if not the most, one of the most segregated cities in the country. It's the indicator, urban inequality indicators and the nexus of race and class still remain tragic and shameful, frankly. So despite the struggle of Father Grappi, the Youth Council, the Commandos, and thousands of other ordinary people, Vel Phillips, Lloyd Barbie, and other people, the large-scale demographic and economic forces that have really ravaged urban America have continued. And this is connected to the rise of the new right here. This is, you know, we've had 30-plus years then of backtracking from even the minor social welfare and urban renewal programs that we had in the post-war period and replaced it with a punitive set of policies that have criminalized black masculinity in cities, that have shifted resources and public policy towards the suburbs, away from cities. I mean, in the 80s with Ronald Reagan, as you well know, I mean, this is someone who has disdain for the cities. And the policy choices made during that era and beyond have just been brutal for urban communities of color. And so in that regard, part of the – I wouldn't say it's a failure of the movement, but there was not a deep enough grappling with these large-scale forces, demographic, economic, and policy forces that are flowing away from our cities in general and particularly urban communities of color.
We have just a couple minutes left. I wanted to bring it forward toward the Obama administration now, and you mentioned the term post-racial. There's all this talk about America entering in the post-racial period here because of the simple fact that we have our first black president. How do you assess that?
Well, it's a great achievement, and as someone who teaches and thinks a lot about race and African-American studies, you know, we need to acknowledge the achievement of that. I think there's real danger, though, in it because, you know, Barack Obama had to be Barack Obama to win, and that means he had to minimize the racial dynamics. He had to play the race-transcendent character to win election. And I think for many whites, the achievement of electing an African-American allows them to think we're kind of beyond race now. We've done it. Where I live in Omaha today, it's the third poorest black community in the country, the poorest for black kids. 60% of all black kids live in poverty, 60%. And it's the fear for me is that in the achievement of this one individual, we lose sight of those bigger issues of race and urban inequality that need to be addressed, and that he's in a box. If he were to step forward and try to address them, there will be many whites who will say, see, look, I told you, he's a black guy, you know, and they'll racialize him and hurt him politically. And we need to address these issues. 60% of black kids living in poverty in Omaha or other cities is shameful.
Similar statistics for Milwaukee, which
exactly.
You studied, somewhere near 50% unemployment in Cleveland, Chicago.
Exactly.
I mean, they've been
this
living
a national
in
story.
Great Depression levels, double Great Depression levels. The Great Depression was 25% unemployment.
Well, I think in Milwaukee during the first 5 years of the Bush administration, the rate of industrial job loss for black men was, you know, around the same levels as it was during the Depression. This
yeah,
is
just,
pre
I,
the current economic
and,
crisis.
And yet I don't hear, and maybe for the very reasons you mentioned, Patrick Jones, I don't hear Barack Obama articulating a new urban policy. That is maybe a tragedy in and of itself. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Patrick Jones has been my guest today. He's the author of The Selma of the North, Civil Rights Insurgency in Milwaukee. Thanks a lot, Patrick.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.